The name of feeling is to kill it. The present is so razor sharp, Leonard has them sidestep it by reminiscing about how they met. But as they do, everything they say about the past betrays a subtext of what they're feeling in the now. They kid about the heart-pounding jailbreak and how they played it cool. But for all Karen knows, she's sitting on a sofa with a smooth-talking rapist. For all Jack knows, there's a SWAT team with a battering ram outside the door. They tease offhandedly about the sexual tension they felt in the trunk of her car, while the heat of the moment blisters the hotel room. And, very importantly, they hide all this behind witty quotes from 3 Days of the Condor. It's at this fifth layer of the unspoken that Leonard unites Karen and Jack. We realize that although they're on opposite sides of the law, at heart, they're a matched pair of diehard romantics hooked on old movies. Layer 6, Dreams. This subtextual insight leads us to imagine the wistful daydreams of Foley and Sisko. While he hopes that she will play Faye Dunaway to his Robert Redford and somehow rescue him, he knows that in fact that will never happen. Sisko can see herself as Dunaway acting out that scenario. It's her wish too, but like Foley, she knows it's an impossible fantasy. Leonard must have loved dialogue, or he couldn't have written it with such skill. So note that his characters also love dialogue. When he has them remember 3 Days of the Condor, they don't recall looks or gestures. They quote lines verbatim. Lines that must have struck Leonard's ear when he saw the film. What is the payoff to the deep insight this scene delivers the reader? Enormous suspense. Will they make love? Will she forget she's a cop and let him escape? Will she arrest him? Will she have to shoot him? Will he be forced to kill her? This seemingly casual talk between forbidden lovers expresses all of the above and more. 30 Rock, Season 5, Episode 1, The Fabian Strategy. This half-hour comedy series takes place in the offices and studios of NBC in New York's Rockefeller Center. John Francis Jack Donaghy, played by Alec Baldwin, serves as vice president of East Coast Television and Microwave Oven Programming for General Electric. Liz Lemon, Tina Fey, works for Jack as producer and head writer of a primetime variety show. Avery, Elizabeth Banks, is Jack's fiancée. The passages you're about to hear sample Jack's verbal style. The phrases and words with emphasis signal his unique characterization and hint at his true character. On his first morning back from summer vacation, Jack calls Liz on the phone.
Oh, Lemon, Avery and I just got back from the most amazing vacation on Paul Allen's yacht. Sheer bliss. Avery is the most perfect woman ever created, like a young Bo Derek stuffed with a Barry Goldwater. But it's back to reality. No more making love on the beach surrounded by a privacy circle of English-trained butlers.
Note, Paul Allen co-founded Microsoft. In a meeting later that day with Liz and her show's producers, Jack fears that the network's weak performance will jeopardize an all-important merger.
In order for our merger to stay attractive to our friends at Cabletown, we have to seem like a sexy, profitable company, and we're almost pulling it off. The Harry Potter theme park is a huge hit with both Anglophiles and pedophiles. The movie division has a James Cameron movie the whole world will see whether they like it or not. Only NBC continues to be the engorged whitehead on the otherwise flawless face of Universal Media.
As their workday ends, Liz confesses that she suffers relationship problems, so Jack gives her this advice.
You can't just do the vacation part. At some point, you have to go home to the same house, unpack your dirty laundry, and have a life together. And one of you says, we should redecorate. And the other says, please, Avery, I'm using the commode right now.
Oh, she wants to redecorate? She just moved in.
Avery has opinions. I love her for that. Unfortunately, she wants to repaint the upstairs hallway in a striey faux finish called husk. I prefer the color that's already there, a reddish-brown shade called elk tongue.
So tell her no. It's your house.
This is how I know you've never had an adult relationship. If I say no, then I will be required to say yes to something else in the future, and the stakes in the future might be higher.
Then say yes.
If I give in, then I'm no longer the alpha in my house. Before you know it, she'll have me wearing jeans and reading fiction.
Yeah, well, yes and no are kind of your only two choices.
For most men, sure. But there is a third option. The Fabian strategy. The Fabian strategy derives its name from the Roman general Quintus Fabius Maximus. He ran away, Lemon. Rather than engage in battle, he would retreat, and retreat until the enemy grew fatigued and eventually made a mistake. Although I abhor it as a military strategy, it is the basis for all my personal relationships.
Jack's handsome face, tailored suits, and $150 haircuts suggest who he might be, but beyond his physical appearance, the writers draw on terms such as sheer bliss, flawless, bowderic, a sexy profitable company, privacy circle, commode, husk, elk tongue, prefer, and abhor to nail his characterization. Modal phrases such as no more, like it or not, you can't, you have to, and if then, signal Jack's sense of power over others. The word and phrase choices in these speeches attest to Jack's command of popular culture, his excellent education, his identification with the upper class, his capitalist ethos, his controlling executive leadership style, and most of all, his supercilious, egoistic snobbery. Together, these traits etch the outer self he shows the world, his characterization. But vocabulary and syntax also throw light on character dimension. A dimension is a contradiction that underpins a character's nature. These psychological stanchions come in two kinds. One, contradictions that play characterization against true character, namely, conflicts between a character's outer traits and his inner truths, between the persona of his visible behavior and the person he hides behind the mask. Two, contradictions that play self against self. These dimensions link the warring forces within true deep character, most often desires from the conscious self at odds with opposite impulses from the subconscious self. Jack's speech style reveals seven such dimensions. He's one, socially sophisticated, Paul Allen's yacht, English-trained butlers, yet privately primal, the alpha in my house, engorged whitehead. Two, unscrupulous, the movie division has a James Cameron film the whole world will see whether they like it or not, yet guilt-ridden. I will be required to say yes. Three, fiscally conservative, Barry Goldwater, yet risk-taking. The Harry Potter theme park is a huge hit with both Anglophiles and pedophiles. Four, well-educated. General Quintus Fabius Maximus invented his guerrilla strategy during the Second Punic War in 218 BC. Yet, self-deceived. The basis for all my personal relationships. And five, intellectually pompous, astrae faux finish, yet factually informed, astrae faux finish. Six, Jack uses devious devices to navigate his personal life, retreat until the enemy grows fatigued and eventually makes a mistake, yet idolizes his relationships with women, most perfect woman ever created. He, seven, is a realist. You can't just do the vacation part, yet a dreamer, a life together. The show's directors constantly pose Jack in a close-up, staring into space, imagining his idealized future. Multidimensional as he is, Jack Donaghy is not, however, a dramatic character. He is, at heart, a comic character driven by a blind obsession. Both dramatic and comic characters seek an object of desire. In that, they are the same. Their core difference, however, is awareness. As a dramatic character pursues his quest, he has sense enough to step back and realize that his struggle could get him killed. Not the comic character. His core desire blinds him. His self-deluded mind fixates on his desire and pursues it wildly unaware. This lifelong mania influences, if not controls, his every choice. Jack Donaghy blithely obsesses on an aristocratic lifestyle more suited to the 1920s than today. Made love on a beach surrounded by a privacy circle of English-trained butlers sounds like a diary entry by Wallis Simpson before she became the Duchess of Windsor. Vacationing on yachts recalls scenes from F. Scott Fitzgerald novels. The love of his life, a fellow aristocrat named Avery, graduated from Choate and Yale. Jack, like the Princeton alumnus he is, disdains jeans and only reads nonfiction. His syntactically balanced sentences roll out rounded with relative clauses. In order for our merger to stay attractive to our friends at Cabletown, we have to seem like a sexy, profitable company, and we're almost pulling it off. And if I say no, then I will be required to say yes to something else in the future, and the stakes in the future might be higher. His dialogue sounds like a tuxedoed businessman talking shop in a penthouse cocktail party. The tuxedo, in fact, is Jack's evening wear of choice. In season one, Liz asks him why he's wearing a tux in his office, and he explains, "It's after six. What am I, a farmer?" Like the clothes they wear, vocabulary and syntax dress characters inside and out. Sideways. Rex Pickett writes both novels and films. In addition to his first novel, Sideways, and a second novel, La Purissima, he wrote the screenplay for the 2000 Oscar-winning short film, My Mother Dreams, The Satan's Disciples in New York. Screenwriters Jim Taylor and Alexander Payne earned writer's credit on the best-written episode of the Jurassic Park franchise, Jurassic Park 3. In addition, they have collaborated with great success on Citizen Ruth, Election, About Schmidt, and Sideways. More recently, Payne wrote and directed The Descendants in 2011 and directed Nebraska in 2013. Sideways, which Payne directed from their adaptation of Pickett's novel, has won a long list of international nominations and awards, including an Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay. As their choice of subject matter suggests, these writers are attracted to life's losers and their futile, often comic struggles to win. Sideways is, by genre, an education plot. Four simple conventions define this very difficult genre. One, the protagonist begins the story with a life-denying mindset. He finds no meaning in the world around him or himself in it. Two, the story will arc the protagonist's downbeat point of view to a positive, life-affirming stance. Three, a teacher character will help guide the protagonist's revolution in attitude. Four, the story's greatest source of conflict will come from the protagonist's beliefs, emotions, habits, and attitudes. In other words, from an inner conflict with his own self-destructive nature. The education plot is a natural genre for a novel because prose allows the writer to directly invade a character's deepest thoughts and feelings. In Pickett's first-person novel, for example, his protagonist whispers his secret fears and doubts directly into the reader's ear. On screen, however, this literary form becomes extremely difficult, requiring superb dialogue to imply within a character what the novelist can explicitly state on page. The screenplay's protagonist, Miles, is a pudgy, divorced, failed novelist who teaches junior high school English. Although no one makes the accusation on screen, he's clearly an alcoholic who hides his dependency behind the mask of, in Miles's word from the novel, a wine cognoscenti. The title Sideways is never explained in the film, but in the novel, sideways is slang for drunk. To go sideways means to get very, very drunk. The teacher role is filled by the intelligent and beautiful Maya, who's also divorced, also a wine lover. Midway through the film, Miles and Maya spend an evening with Miles' pal Jack and Maya's friend Stephanie. They all end up at Stephanie's house. When Jack and Stephanie retire to the bedroom, Miles and Maya sit in the living room sipping wine from Stephanie's excellent collection. At first they chat about how they met. He was a customer in a restaurant where she waits tables. Then the subject turns first to Miles, his novel, and then to Maya, her M.A. in agrology, and finally to their mutual love of wine.
Why are you so obsessed with Pinot? That's all you ever order.
Miles smiles wistfully at the question. He searches for an answer in his glass and begins slowly.
I don't know. It's a hard grape to grow, as you know. It's thin-skinned, temperamental. It's not a survivor like Cabernet that can grow and thrive anywhere and withstand neglect. Pinot's only happy in specific little corners of the world, and it needs a lot of doting. Only the patient and faithful and caring growers can do it, can access Pinot's fragile, achingly beautiful qualities. It doesn't come to you. You have to come to it, see? It takes the right combination of soil and sun and love to coax it into its fullest expression. Then, and only then, its flavors are the most thrilling and brilliant and haunting on the planet.
Maya has found this answer revealing and moving.
I mean, Cabernets can be powerful and exalting, but they seem prosaic to me for some reason, by comparison. How about you? Why do you like wine so much?
I suppose I got really into wine originally through my ex-husband. He had a big, kind of show-off cellar. But then I found out that I have a really sharp palate. And the more I drank, the more I liked what it made me think about.
Yeah? Like what?
I started to appreciate the life of wine, that it's a living thing, that it connects you more to life. I like to think about what was going on the year the grapes were growing. I like to think about how the sun was shining that summer and what the weather was like. I think about all those people who tended and picked the grapes. And if it's an old wine, how many of them must be dead by now? I love how wine continues to evolve. How every time I open a bottle, the wine will taste different than if I had uncorked it on any other day, or at any other moment. A bottle of wine is like life itself. It grows up, evolves, and gains complexity. Then it peaks, like you're 61, and begins its steady, inexorable decline. And it tastes so fucking good.
Now it's Miles's turn to be swept away. Maya's face tells us the moment is right, but Miles remains frozen. He needs another sign, and Maya is bold enough to offer it. She reaches out and places one hand atop his.
But I like a lot of wines besides Pinot, too. Lately, I've really been into Rieslings. Do you like Rieslings?
She nods, a Mona Lisa smile on her lips.
Bathroom over there?
Yeah.
Miles gets up and walks out. Maya sighs and gets an American Spirit out of her purse. Like the scene from Leonard's Out of Sight, this is a seduction, but in this case, between two very sensitive people. The sage Earth Mother Maya and the emotional wallflower Miles. Like the scene from Lost in Translation, we'll hear later, it's an exchange of revelations. But they are not confessing personal failures. Rather, the underlying actions of both characters are bragging and promising. Miles and Maya try hard to sell their virtues to each other. In the subtext of Miles's big speech, he invites Maya to come to him. And in the subtext of her reply, she does, and brilliantly. So that she leaves no doubt about her desire for him, she even touches his hand and smiles a Mona Lisa come on. Miles chickens out, bolts for the toilet, and leaves her in frustration. Once again, note how the scene is designed through a trialogue. Wine becomes the third thing under which the subtext pulses. Now, I'll rewrite their speeches on the nose, pulling the bragging and promising from the subtext and putting it directly into the text by eliminating the third thing.
I'm a hard guy to get to know. I'm thin-skinned and temperamental. I'm not tough, not a hard-hearted survivor. I need a cozy, safe little world and a woman who will dote on me. But if you are patient and faithful and caring, you will bring out my beautiful qualities. I cannot come to you. You must come to me. Do you understand? With the right kind of coaxing love, I will turn into the most thrilling and brilliant man you could ever have the luck to know.
I am a woman with a passion for life. Hour after hour, day after day, season after season, I thrive in the golden light of time, savoring its every precious spell. I am in my prime, old enough to have learned from mistakes, young enough to grow and evolve, so that with every passing day I will become ever more complex, ever more amazing. When I peak, and believe me, I am peaking at this very moment with you, I will taste good. Oh, so very, very good. Please fuck me.
A person might feel such feelings, might even think such thoughts in some vague way, but no one would ever say these embarrassingly painful things aloud. This bald language becomes impossibly corny when put directly into a living room chat about ideas and yearnings. Fine actors would choke on it. Yet these are exactly the actions that Taylor and Payne want their characters to take. To put themselves in the very best light, and to promise the moon in an effort to win the love of the other with seductive boasts and promises. So, how to write these beats of action into dialogue? Let them converse. How do people converse? By using what they know as a third thing. And what do these characters know? Miles and Maya are experts on two subjects, wine and themselves. They have extensive practical knowledge of the former and romanticized, idealized knowledge of the latter. So using the nature of wine and its cultivation as metaphor for their own natures, they each campaign to win the esteem of the other. As I laid out in the beginning of this section, the key is vocabulary. Character-specific dialogue originates in a character's unspoken desires and the actions he takes to satisfy those desires. Actions become talk that translates the character's implicit thoughts and feelings into explicit words, the precise words that only that specific character would use in that specific moment, taking that specific action. Drawing on Pickett's novel, Payne and Taylor have added their knowledge and insight to Miles and Maya and given each a character-specific voice and vocabulary. In order to seduce, Miles and Maya describe themselves in the language of wine. Compare, for example, Miles's modal language, his sensitive adjectives and adverbs, to Maya's bold naming, her nouns and verbs. Miles. Thin-skinned, temperamental, doting, faithful, caring, fragile, have to come to, achingly beautiful, thrilling, brilliant, haunting, really been into, versus Maya, life, living thing, connects to life, life itself, sun, shining, summer, evolves, gains, peaks, tastes so fucking good. These writers have an ear for their characters. Part 4. Dialogue Design. Chapter 12. Story, Scene, Dialogue. Now and then we experience a flawed story that squandered surprisingly good dialogue. We have all waded through badly told stories with dreadful dialogue, but we rarely encounter a superbly told story ruined by lousy dialogue. And the reason is simple. Quality storytelling inspires quality dialogue. Like a hectic fever, bad dialogue warns of a festering infection deep within a story. But because struggling writers often mistake the symptom for the disease, they try to bandage scenes by obsessively rewriting their dialogue, thinking that once the talk is right, the telling will heal. But maladies of character and event cannot be cured by scratching dialogue raw with draft after draft of paraphrases. To put it as clearly as I can, until you know what you're talking about, you cannot know how your characters go about talking. The order in which you create your story's components and how you bring these pieces together is unique to you. But no matter how helter-skelter the process, an author ultimately gathers godlike knowledge of form, event, and cast design, and content, cultural, historical, and psychological substance, to support the telling from the bottom up, to create dialogue from the inside out. Dialogue is the final step, the frosting of text atop layers and layers of subtext. So, before we examine dialogue design, let's review the basic components of story design. Inciting incident. At the opening of a story, the central character's life rests in a state of relative balance. She has her ups and downs, who doesn't? Nonetheless, the protagonist holds reasonable sovereignty over her existence. until something happens that radically upsets that equilibrium. We call this event the inciting incident. To incite means to start. Incident means event. This first major event starts the story by throwing the protagonist's life out of kilter. The inciting incident could happen by decision. She decides to quit her job and open her own business. Or by coincidence. Lightning strikes her store and she loses her business. The inciting incident could move her life powerfully to the positive. She invents a brilliant new product. Or to the negative, a business rival steals her invention. The inciting incident could be a massive social event. Her corporation goes bankrupt. Or a quiet inner event. Comes to realize in her heart of hearts that she hates her career. Story values. The impact of the inciting incident decisively changes the charge of the value at stake in the character's life. Story values are binaries of positive-negative charge, such as life-death, courage-cowardice, truth-lie, meaningfulness-meaninglessness, maturity-immaturity, hope-despair, justice-injustice, to name but a few. A story may incorporate any number, variety, and possible combinations of story values, but it anchors its content in an irreplaceable core value. A core value is irreplaceable because it determines the story's fundamental nature. Change core value, change the genre. For example, if a writer were to extract love-hate from her characters' lives and substitute morality-immorality, this switch in core values would pivot her genre from love story to redemption plot. The values and scenes can be very complex, but at minimum, every scene contains at least one story value at stake in the character's life. This value either relates to or matches the story's core value. Scenes dramatize change in the charge of this value. A scene may begin with its value at either a purely positive charge, purely negative charge, or an admixture of both. Through conflicts and/or revelations, the opening charge of value changes. It could reverse, positive to negative, negative to positive, intensify, positive to doubly positive, negative to doubly negative, or wane, purely positive to a weaker positive, purely negative to a weaker negative. The precise moment in which the charge of one or more values changes is a scene's turning point. Therefore, a story event occurs the instant a value at stake in a scene changes charge. The complex of desire. Everyone wants reasonable sovereignty over existence. By throwing life out of balance, the inciting incident arouses the natural human desire to restore balance. Essentially, therefore, all stories dramatize the human struggle to move life from chaos to order, from imbalance to equilibrium. Characters act because needs demand deeds. But the complexity of life swirls through a labyrinth of desires. Ultimately, the art of storytelling merges and organizes many streams of desire into a flow of events. The storyteller picks and chooses only those desires he wishes to express in the specific scenes that progress his story from beginning to end. To understand this process, we need to examine the components of desire and how they propel storytelling. Desire is a figure in five dimensions. 1, object of desire. 2, super intention. 3, motivation. 4, scene intention. 5, background desires. 1, object of desire. In the wake of the inciting incident, the protagonist conceives of an object of desire, that which he feels he must have in order to put his life back on an even keel. This object could be something physical, like a stash of money, or situational, like revenge for an injustice, or ideational, like a faith to live by. Example, a humiliation on the job, inciting incident, has damaged the protagonist's reputation, radically upsetting the balance of his life, so he seeks a victory in the workplace, object of desire, to restore balance. 2. Superintention. The superintention motivates a character to pursue the object of desire. This phrase restates the protagonist's conscious desire in terms of his deepest need. For example, the object of desire we just looked at, victory in the workplace, rephrased as the superintention becomes to gain inner peace through a public triumph. In other words, the object of desire is objective, whereas the superintention is subjective. What the protagonist wants versus the emotional hunger that drives him. The former term gives the writer a clear view of the crisis scene that waits at the end of the story when the protagonist will either get or fail to get his object of desire. The latter term connects the writer to the feelings within the protagonist, the inner need that drives the telling. In every story, the protagonist's superintention is somewhat generic. For example, to win justice through revenge, to find happiness in intimate love, to live a meaningful life. But the exact object of desire, for example, a dead villain, an ideal mate, a reason not to commit suicide, gives a story originality. Whatever the object of desire may be, the protagonist wants it because he must satisfy his superintention, his profound longing for a life in balance. 3. Motivation. Do not confuse either object of desire or superintention with motivation. The first two answer what questions. What does the character consciously want? What does he subconsciously need? Motivation answers why. Why does a character need what he feels he needs? Why does a character want this particular object of desire? And if he gets what he wants, will this success actually satisfy his need? The roots of motivation reach deep into childhood, and for that reason are often irrational. How much you understand the whys of your character's needs and wants is up to you. Some writers, like Tennessee Williams, obsess on motivation. Some writers, like Shakespeare, ignore it. Either way, what's essential to the writing of scenes and their dialogue is an understanding of the character's conscious and subconscious desires. 4. Scene intention. A scene shapes a character's moment-by-moment struggle toward his ultimate life goal. Scene intention names what a character immediately wants as a step in the long-term effort of the superintention. As a result, the actions he takes and the reactions he gets in each scene will either take him closer to or bend him further away from his object of desire. If the writer were to grant the character his scene intention, the scene would stop. For example, in a police interrogation scene, character A wants character B to stop questioning him. A's scene intention is to stop the interrogation. If B were to give up and leave the room, the scene would end. B, on the other hand, wants A to reveal a secret. From B's point of view, his scene intention is to discover the secret. If A were to confess, that too would end the scene. Scene intention names the character's imminent conscious desire, what he wants right now. 5. Background desires. A character's background desires limit his choices of action. Each of us is constantly aware of the state of the relationship between ourselves and every person and every object we encounter in life. Our safety in traffic, which table the maitre d' gives us, our place in the hierarchy of co-workers, to name just three public examples. We are acutely aware of our private rapport with friends, family, and lovers. We're also attuned to our innermost self, our relative state of physical, mental, emotional, and moral well-being. What's more, we're aware of our place in the flow of time, of our experiences in the past, the knife edge of the present, and what we hope for the future. These complex, interwoven relationships create our background desires. Relationships become desires in this way. Once created, relationships form the foundation of our existence. They create the system that gives us our sense of identity and security in life. Our well-being depends on them. We try to eliminate relationships of negative value, while at the same time maintaining, if not improving, positive relationships. At the very least, we want relationships of either kind kept within reasonable control. Background desires, therefore, not only cement the status quo of a character's life, they temper his behavior. Background desires form a web of restraints that follows every character into every scene. These fixed desires for stability limit and temper the character's actions. They influence what the character will or will not say to get what he wants. In principle, the more relationships of positive value a character accumulates in life, the more restrained, the more civilized his behavior. The reverse is also true. When a character has nothing to lose, he's capable of anything. In some cultures, because of social mores, you can speak your mind. In other cultures, for the same reason, you must obey unspoken codes of address and keep your thoughts to yourself. Humanity's enormous range of cultures creates a spectrum of polar extremes that spans from cultures that are all subtext with hardly any text versus cultures that are all text with very little subtext. In the social sciences, these polar extremes are known as high context versus low context cultures. In fiction, they determine the relative quantity of text versus subtext. High context cultures have a strong sense of tradition and history. They change very slowly over time, and so from generation to generation, their members hold many beliefs and experiences in common. A high-context culture will be relational, collectivistic, intuitive, and contemplative. It places high value on interpersonal relationships within a close-knit community. Native Americans, for example. As a result, within these in-groups, many things can be left unsaid because the members can easily draw inferences from their shared culture and experiences. The Italian Mafia is such an in-group. In The Godfather, when Michael Corleone says, "My father made him an offer he couldn't refuse," an entire episode of extortion becomes violently clear. Michael then goes on to make the event explicit to Kay Adams because she's not in the in-group. High-context cultures, such as those in the Middle East and Asia, have low ethnic and social diversity. They value community over the individual. In-group members rely on their common background rather than words to explain situations. Consequently, dialogue within high-context cultures calls for extreme economy and precise word choices because within such settings, a few subtle words can implicitly express a complex message. Conversely, characters in low-context cultures, such as North America, tend to explain things at greater length because the people around them come from a wide variety of racial, religious, class, and nationalistic backgrounds. Even within the same general cultures, these differences appear. Compare, for example, two American stereotypes, a Louisianan, a high-context culture, and a New Yorker, a low-context culture. The former uses a few tacit words and prolonged silences. The latter talks frankly and at length. What's more, in low-context cultures, shared experiences change constantly and drastically, thus creating communication gaps from one generation to the next. In immigrant societies such as the United States, parents and children have notoriously difficult communication problems that result in long, loud arguments. Characters become more verbose and explicit as subtext shallows out. Forces of antagonism. As a character pursues her object of desire, she consciously or instinctively designs actions that she hopes will cause helpful, enabling reactions from her world, reactions that she expects will move her closer to a balanced life. But, instead of getting cooperation, her actions arouse forces of antagonism that thwart her efforts. Her world reacts differently, more powerfully, in contrast or contradiction to what she reckoned. This surprising violation of expectation may move her further from or closer to her object of desire, but whether positive or negative, the turn will not happen in the way she imagined. The term forces of antagonism does not necessarily refer to an antagonist or villain. Villains inhabit certain genres, and in his proper place, an arch-villain such as the Terminator can be a fascinating antagonist. But by forces of antagonism, I mean opposing forces from any or all of the four levels of conflict. 1. Physical conflict. The titanic forces of time, space, and every object in the man-made and natural universe. Not enough time to get something done. Too far to go to get something. Nature's tumult from tornadoes to viruses. To these natural forces, fantasy genres add supernatural and magical forces of amazing variety and unlimited imaginings. 2. Social conflict. The powerful forces of institutions and the people who run them. All levels of government and the legal systems they enforce. All religions, the military, corporations, schools, hospitals, even charities. Every institution shapes itself into a pyramid of power. How do you gain it, lose it, how do you move up and down the pyramid of power? 3. Personal conflict. The problematic relationships of intimacy between friends, family, and lovers that range from infidelity to divorce to petty squabbles over money. 4. Inner conflict. Contradictory forces within a character's mind, body, and emotions. How to cope when your memory betrays you, your body breaks down, or your feelings overwhelm your common sense. Over the progressive dynamics of a story, forces from these various levels build in power and focus, deepening and widening the story. As these complications build, the protagonist reacts by digging deeper and deeper into her willpower, as well as her mental, emotional, and physical capacities in an ever-escalating effort to restore life's balance. Spine of action. A story's spine of action traces the protagonist's constant quest for his object of desire. His persistent pursuit, driven by his superintention, struggling against the forces of antagonism, propels the entire telling from the inciting incident through the story's progressions to the protagonist's eventual crisis decision and climactic action, ending in a moment of resolution. What the protagonist, or any character, does from scene to scene or says from line to line is simply a behavioral tactic. No matter what happens on the surface, no matter how outer activity catches our eye and ear, the protagonist's grand, unrelenting spine of action runs under every scene. Because other people are the most common source of life's complications, the most common activity taken along the spine of action is talk. And like the five major movements of story, inciting incident, progressive complications, crisis, climax, resolution, talk has its own five stages. Desire, sense of antagonism, choice of action, action-reaction, expression. Of these stages, expression is the activity that carries the character's action into his world. It's most often speech, but it may be clenching a fist or planting a kiss, hurling a plate across a room, or smiling deceitfully. All the nonverbal activities that may accompany or substitute for dialogue. Imagine this story. You are a first-time writer trying to break into the profession. In that secret place where you hide from the world, you feel incomplete as you teeter through life. You dream of a creative triumph that will give you wholeness and balance, a novel, play, a script of surpassing quality, object of desire. Your need to achieve artistic success, super intention, drives your writing life, spine of action. You sit down, scene, and pursue your desire by attempting to write a page of dialogue, choice of action, because you hope it will unlock insight into your characters and story events to come, scene intention. But before you begin, you know that a pernicious horde of forces will oppose your efforts. Your mother will call. The baby will wake up. Fears of failure will churn your belly. The temptation to quit will whisper in your ear. Sources of antagonism. In the face of these forces, you choose to stay at your desk and persevere. Choice of action. And so you write and rewrite the same passage over and over. Action. But with each pass, your dialogue stumbles, sputters, and only gets worse. Force of antagonism. You spew a chain of hyphenated profanity. Stupid, damn, mother, son of a... expression. Suddenly, from out of nowhere, a new angle of attack springs to mind. Reaction. You pound out dialogue that reshapes the scene with surprising power. Action. You lean back and mutter, "Wow! Where did that come from?" Expression. Every immediate desire and action, no matter how seemingly trivial, even a thing as infinitesimal as taking a thought-filled sip of coffee, is somehow affixed to your future desire and your pursuit of literary achievement. Moment by moment, your life moves along a spine of action from desire to sense of antagonism to choice of action, to action-reaction, to expression. As for you, so for your characters. As for your life, so for your stories. Story progression. The scenes along the spine of action not only move dynamically across the positive-negative charges of the story's values, but they arc along a progression of conflict. As a character struggles toward his object of desire, the forces of antagonism build, calling on greater and greater capacities from within him, generating greater and greater jeopardy in his life, demanding greater and greater willpower to make more and more risk-taking decisions. Finally, there comes a moment when the protagonist has exhausted all possible actions save one. Faced with the most powerful and focused conflict of his life, the protagonist must choose one final action in a last effort to put his life back in balance. He makes his crisis decision, chooses a climactic action, and takes it. Out of the climax, he either gets what he wants or fails to get it. End of story. A last resolution scene may be needed to tie up any loose ends and let the reader or audience gather their thoughts and recoup their emotions. Turning points. Ideally, every scene contains a turning point. A turning point pivots the instant the value at stake in the scene dynamically changes from positive to negative or negative to positive. This change moves the character either further from negative or closer to positive, his object of desire, than the previous scene's turning point. Turning points progress the story along its spine of action toward a final satisfaction or dissatisfaction of the protagonist's desire at story climax. A turning point can be created in only one of two ways, by action or revelation. An event turns either by an immediate direct action or by the disclosure or discovery of a secret or previously unknown fact. Because dialogue can express both deeds, I'm leaving for good, and information, I married you for your money, it can turn a scene's value charge by action, revelation, or both at once. If a scene has no turning point, if the value charge does not change in any kind or degree, then the scene is merely an exposition-filled non-event. Too many non-events in a row, and a story collapses into tedium. Scene progression. Progression means the continuous topping of previous actions or events. A scene creates a turning point that progresses the storyline by topping the turning point in the previous scene. Each sequence of events causes a moderate change that surpasses the previous in terms of its impact, for better or worse, on the lives of the characters. Each act climax delivers a major impact. But no matter whether a scene creates a minor, moderate, or major change in the story, the scene progresses within itself by building beats of behavior, so that each action-reaction tops the previous beat to and around the scene's turning point. The beat. Like the physical objects governed by Newton's third law of motion, every verbal action causes a reaction. The beat is a unit of scene design that contains both an action and a reaction from someone or something somewhere in the setting. Generally, the response comes from another character, but it could come from within the acting character himself. Suppose character A were to insult character B. Character B could react in myriad ways, perhaps with an insult of his own, or by laughing at character A. Or character A could react to his own action and apologize. Or character A could regret what he said, feel remorse, but say nothing. Or character B, who doesn't speak English, greets the insult with a smile. These moment-by-moment exchanges of action-reaction build a scene. Ideally, each beat tops the previous beat and leads to the next. This continuous surpassing of previous beats within a scene generates dialogue progression, shaping the scene's beats to and around its turning point. Beats are best identified by gerunds. A gerund is a noun that names an action by adding ing to a verb. The four possible beats above, for example, could be labeled insulting, ridiculing, insulting, apologizing, insulting, regretting, insulting, greeting. The use of gerunds to name the actions beneath the exchanges of dialogue is the best way I know to stop yourself from writing on the nose. Five steps of behavior. When characters use what they say to pursue what they want, the rambling activity of conversation turns into the focused action of dialogue. Verbal action, indeed all behavior, moves through five distinct steps from desire to antagonism to choice to action to expression. Because people often act and react in a flash, these steps seem fused together because they fly from first to last in a blur. But that's life, not writing. No matter how quickly and instinctively things might happen, the five steps are always there. To make the flow of character behavior as clear as possible, let's examine these five steps in slow motion detail. 1. Desire. The moment a character's life is thrown out of balance, inciting incident, he, in reaction, conceives of, or at least senses, what he must achieve in order to restore life's balance, object of desire. His overarching purpose to reach the object of desire, superintention, motivates his active pursuit, spine of action. As he moves along the story's spine, at each specific moment, scene, he must satisfy an immediate want, scene intention, in order to progress toward his object of desire. The foreground desire of scene intention and the underlying pull of the superintention influences every choice of action he makes and takes.